The Local Government News Roundup is proudly supported by Davidson. For 30 years, Davidson has been strengthening the local government sector by identifying and providing the people, expertise and experience that local government needs to enhance its capability, productivity and performance. Davidson is nationally recognised for its executive recruitment services and over the past 4 years has built a business advisory practice rapidly evolving into one of the nation's foremost and trusted local government business consultancy firms. The Davidson methodology and approach is simple. Thinking beyond now and aiming to be a valued partner with your local government, not just for the immediate project, but for the next 30 years. Speak to Justin Hanney or Seamus Scanlon to find out more, or head to davidsonwp.com.au. Davidson, your future, your partner. Hello, welcome to the Local Government News Roundup and another in our Roundup Unfiltered series. I'm Chris Eddy. The National Growth Areas Alliance is the peak body for local governments in Australia's fast-growing outer cities and suburbs. It represents more than 5 million people, united by the shared experiences of population growth rates at double the national average and long-term underinvestment in vital infrastructure. Today on Roundup Unfiltered, I sit down with the chair of the group, Councillor Matthew Deeth from Wallandilly Shire Council in New South Wales, and the NGAA's CEO Bronwyn Clark to discuss a range of issues faced by growth councils across the country, including their role in meeting housing demands, infrastructure delivery, and the challenges of climate change. Matthew, Bronwyn, great to have you on the Local Government News Roundup and to talk a bit about the challenges being faced by growth councils pretty much across the country. Matt, can I start with you firstly? Deputy Mayor of Wallandilly Shire Council and a former mayor, how long have you been wearing the chair hat at NGAA?
Oh, gosh, excellent question. And Bron, I should know the answer to this, but 3 years. Great. Thank you, Bron, for your assistance. Yeah, look, it's been great three years and just jam-packed. It's just been an incredible opportunity to be able to voice and advocate for those in outer growth areas and those new suburbs popping up right across our country.
So we'll talk a bit about those particular areas and the challenges that they're facing. But Bronwyn Clark, CEO of the NGAA, you've been in this role, I think, for about 6 years. How did you find yourself in this position?
You know what? It was a calling, Chris, I'm going to say. I had worked in government for most of my career and public relations after that. And being, someone who grew up in a growth area of Melbourne and knew the restrictions and limitations that people faced just from where they lived, when this role came up, I thought, yeah, I know that those limitations and restrictions still exist and I want to be able to do something about it. So, yeah, it's a calling.
Lovely answer. Lovely answer. So how was the NGAA formed and when did that happen?
That happened, well, we're probably coming up to about 15 years ago now when, there was a, as you know, Australia has these waves of growth and waves of suburban development. And there had been one, late 90s, around the turn of this century. And suddenly all of these councils realised their populations had exploded and they had not received sufficient infrastructure funding to meet the needs of their communities. So some research was done. And the late, great David Turnbull led the charge at the City of Whittlesea and got a national group together that really wanted to put these issues on the map and on the political agenda because, individually these councils were all going through the same thing and collectively they could try and actually raise the issues in Parliament, state and federal.
Do you think, was it a hard sell at the time or were people really ready to come together in that way?
I think they were ready to come together because from what I understand, that they're sort of all in a bit of shock, I suppose. You know, this is really significant change that happened very quickly and is still happening in that same way for our members and others right across the country. So, you know, it's as much a helping hand and a support network to really connect with people and councils and organisations that are going through the same challenges that they are.
Let's get into some of those challenges. Matt, we hear a lot about the things that local government as a sector broadly is dealing with currently, rising costs, you know, the whole cost of living issue, infrastructure challenges, etc. Are the challenges for growth councils any different to your run-of-the-mill council, if you'll excuse that expression, or are they the same just on a bigger scale?
Yes to both of those suggestions there, Chris. I think one of the things that really defines growth areas is our unique set of challenges that you don't see replicated in the larger metro councils or in the rural or regional councils that you see across Australia. Things like financial management is chalk and cheese because of the significant growth that we're experiencing and the impacts that has on the delivery of local infrastructure and also the state and federal infrastructure at the same time. So it's very different in terms of the trajectory of the requirements for growth areas and the challenges around how we deliver those to make these places great places to live. We want to ensure that these places are exactly have all the values that our existing places that we have within our shires or local government areas have. It comes down to not only is it financial impacts but there's the external factors around how immigration occurs and where those patterns of settlement occur, which Bron's been doing a lot of work in that regard. And then how do we plan for those growth areas as they come online? Because there's one of the challenges that we have in between all three levels of government is there's really no clear planning that's done for how we settle new people into new areas and how do we plan for that. In fact, I would suggest that local government is at the forefront of a lot of this work and a lot of our member councils do some incredible stuff there, but they unfortunately we need to educate and bring along with us our state and federal counterparts, which is part of the work that the NGAA do. It's fundamental if we're actually going to start to solve some of the challenges that we've got in growth areas.
If I can just pick up on that point about working with other levels of government, I'm, as you may know, a keen observer of how local government functions across the country, and it's not a one-size-fits-all situation when you go from state to state. How does that impact on the work you're trying to do, bringing those levels of government together? Because I imagine in some states it's more of a challenge than in others.
One of the key things that the National Growth Areas Alliance excels at is taking these really complex local issues and bringing them up to a really big picture, strategic, long-term solutions focus scale. So we don't just go in with a list of asks, we go in with some really sensible policy solutions based on research that we've conducted and that we've been part of, based on our own members' experience. And that brings in some credibility, increases our credibility, the seriousness with which the federal government engages with us. And it means that we're not, as I said, we're not just going in with some sort of long list of things that we've of money that we want of funding that we want. That opens doors for us because whether it's at the state level or the federal, we can go with an understanding of how things function right across the country. And quite often we'll have a discussion at the state level suggesting great ways to do things that they've never heard of, and it's happening just across the state border. Or we talk to the federal government extensively about where they can show leadership where within constitutional law that they're allowed to and they're permitted to, where they can actually show their leadership and bring states along for a best practice solution. But we can bring all of that from a on-the-ground perspective to those different levels of government.
Matt, as chair, how does that impact your role, given there are differences from state to state?
I think that is the role of both Bron and I in terms of our advocacy is to highlight that opportunity to both state and federal government. And I've got to say that over the time that I have been involved, I have seen a real shift in, particularly the federal level, in acknowledgement of the opportunities that local government bring to the table and wanting to engage with that. And our infrastructure minister has very much keenly engaged with the NGAA because she can see that we do provide that opportunity, also the solution focus that's evidence-based. And I've got to say that I think because of the challenges facing growth area councils, we have been best placed to innovate and find the solutions because we have no other option but not find those solutions. So, and I think that the federal and the state, sorry, not so much as the state, but the federal level has certainly seen that there's a strength in having a robust and continuous conversation with our councils around how best to shift policy, not necessarily the individual projects as Bron has said, but how to shift policy to get better outcomes in our outer suburban areas. So I'm really quite heartened about the future for growth areas and particularly for that collaboration between governments, because we're seeing real genuine engagement in how we can better shift and deliver, I mean, great communities. That's at the end of the day, that's why we're all involved in local government, is because we want to see great communities and great places to live.
How do you choose what issues to get involved in collectively? You know, I'm thinking, you know, there's a major review of the financial model just announced in New South Wales. There's been some reforms in Western Australia, all of which must have an impact on the growth councils in those states. Do you get involved at that level?
To a degree we do, yes, although we are a very small team. We're a lean organisation, just three staff. But what we have is the brains trust of our mayors, councillors and officers. And so quite often we'll play a role in, helping our members work through those things at the state level rather than taking the lead ourselves. And it's about sharing resources, connecting councils with those in other states who are experiencing similar issues, or, you know, looking at different legislative reviews or, granny flat models that are happening in Perth, for example. And, our members have been through that. So we can, you know, it's really bolstering each other capacity to respond. Yeah. It's not always handing everything to the Alliance Secretariat to respond, but it's about, making sure that all of our members, we can assist build their capacity to do the best in their municipalities.
And just to add to what Bron has said there, Chris, I think one of the trends that I have seen, or the shifts that I've seen in the industry over the last 8 years that I've been involved, is the shift away from advocacy at a local government level to focusing more on alliances and collaborations or groups of like-minded individuals when it comes to advocacy and their effectiveness and their ability to engage at both the state and federal level. State and federal governments are not looking to engage at a local government level because there's just so many to engage with. But they're wanting to see groups of people coming together to solve key issues across multiple stakeholders. So I think that that is something that we do incredibly well across our member councils, and as Bron said, drawing on all of their expertise to be able to answer some of these questions has allowed us to be, I guess, a voice that is listened to at all levels of government, which is something that I'm very proud of, that we're considered as experts in whatever we're responding to.
And can I add there too that, you know, quite often state governments might have some very sort of localised focus on the big picture issues like climate change. But from a policy perspective, there are policy levers and settings at the national level that the federal government implements and sets that impact every resident of the country and every municipality. And so that's why we, you know, try and maintain or choose those issues which are going to impact our members across the board. So whether it's responding to climate change or natural disasters, which, you know, we continue to build as a nation new suburbs in bushfire-prone areas and flood zones, which is, you know, very high numbers of people who are moving for the first time into these disaster-prone areas. So a national housing policy, a national settlement policy. I've been fortunate enough to be appointed to the Infrastructure Minister's Urban Policies Forum because the Albanese government will present an urban policy. What does it look like? You know, what does housing look like? We've got these immense housing targets, but every municipality has to respond to that. And so how do we take all of those local experiences and knowledge up to a federal level and try and, you know, hit that mark at the top to make the policy right in the first place?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Local Government News Roundup is brought to you by the Victorian Local Governance Association. As Victorian councils go to elections later this year, the VLGA is ready to support communities and councils in good governance. A series of workshops has been designed to increase understanding of the local government sector, the work of councils, and the role of a councillor. Registrations are being taken now for workshops in May on Standing for Local Government and Local Women Leading Change. And member councils should look out for the VLGA's 2024 Local Government Election Pre-Candidate Prospectus, available soon. Find out more about how the VLGA can support your council and community during this important time in the local government election cycle. Visit vlga.org.au.
One of the issues on our list of challenges that we thought we might talk about if we had time was this issue of trust in government. Generally, that's, you know, people's perception of levels of government and local government. I think most surveys would tell you rates generally higher than a state or a federal level. How do you see that impacting on what growth councils are trying to do for their communities? Is it a barrier, Matt?
I'm interested to hear what Brum will say on this particular. We haven't compared notes on this, but I think it does have an impact. And I have seen over that growth areas go through a rapid pace of change very quickly. And the challenge for local governments is bringing their existing communities along with them on that journey and getting those communities to see not only the benefits, but the long-term plan for those areas that are shifting. It's very hard for local government to do, and more so since we've seen the demise of, I guess, local news outlets right across our communities that provided that source of truth. So it's very hard to convince our community sometimes from a local government perspective when you don't have that the voice of truth that the local media once played in that role there. So councils have got an increasing burden and need to better communicate with their communities. And look, I've seen countless examples of great local government areas and the work that they've done in transforming how they communicate directly to their their residents, but it is an increasing burden because we've seen that trend away from local news outlets as a source of truth and more towards the use of social media. We're seeing more and more that is impacting and influencing local government because of that social media. And it's a great tool, but that's something that is, once again, it's a challenge that we have to continually address.
Yeah, I think Matt's made some really good points there, and I'd probably look at it from a slightly different perspective, not being, an elected member and not working solely within one council, for example, is that I think a lot of it comes down to how new neighbourhoods are built. How we develop that sense of place, which creates some social connection, some social cohesion. And if a community knows each other, knows their neighbours, I feel, I probably don't have a lot of evidence right at my fingertips to back this up, but I feel they tend to not seek out everything from somewhere else, which is where some of that trust or lack of trust evolves. So if people move into a new area expecting everything to be there right at the moment they move in and for it all to be provided and they don't have to put effort in, then when it's not delivered, they're going to mistrust the nearest level of government that they can pin the blame on. But when suburbs and developments are built in a really great way, and there are many examples of that with, public space, a community centre, a youth centre, some sports field. So not the full gamut of infrastructure, but enough to actually start some social cohesion. I think that builds community resilience from day one. And, I reckon people who, the 5.3 million people living in growth areas and many who've moved in the past 5 to 10 years are incredibly resilient because they've just had to get on and do things. They've just had to get on and live their best life with the facilities they have. And so I think the more that local government can be supported to negotiate with developers, to negotiate with state government, to build these community facilities, the more trust will be engendered and the less residents will want to blame someone for their lack of whatever it might be.
That's really interesting, Bronwyn. One thing I didn't hear you mention there, because councils don't necessarily deliver it, is the major road infrastructure, the rail infrastructure, the public transport, etc. And we hear a lot of talk about how the delivery of that sort of infrastructure to cater for growth is always after the fact or too late and not proactive, despite, lots of reports and studies saying it needs to be. Is it possible to turn that around, Matt or Bronwyn, or is it in the too hard basket?
Oh, look, I'm half jokingly to say it's probably one of my KPIs, but I think it's a bit big for one person to to achieve. But this comes to our sort of key advocacy points, which is with a national housing policy, and if we could get a national settlement policy, we can encourage and direct where development happens holistically. So at the moment, that's really done just at the state level. And what happens is, and we've seen it, I'll hand over to Matt to give an example out at Wilton in his municipality, but things happen where it could be 6, 7, 10 years ago the precinct structure plan was developed. Times change. Lot sizes shrink, more people live in the area than was ever planned for. And so the state government makes those decisions, local government has to respond, and federal government's left back at the beginning 10 years ago saying, yeah. Oh, well, we'll in our 10-year plan, we'll build that freeway extension. But it's actually needed at year 3. Mm-hmm. And then things will happen and it will be delayed and it will be year 15. Or, so that's where we'd love to see the federal government set those strategies and mandate them and implement them. And, you know, things happen so much in real time that change the outcome that someone needs to actually someone needs to hold those, you know, those puppet strings and control it in a way that doesn't leave whole vast new populations without a train station or without a bus service or, you know, without, you know, having a direct entry from their suburb onto a freeway or a highway, which is so dangerous. Anyway, Matt, there's a great example out your way to talk.
Let's hear about this example, Matt.
Completely agree with Bron. And it's that, that's that level of coordination as you plan. Like when you're talking a 10-year window, it can be done. It's just there needs to be better coordination between not only this, the levels of government and the policy settings at the top, but also the agencies that are involved in the engagement. And look, the example that comes to mind is out at Wilton, which is in the area that I live, which is 80 kilometres southwest of Sydney, very close to the new airport, the new Western Sydney airport. And we're at a position right now where the policy settings at the time of the day has led to a situation where proper planning hasn't been put in place for the design and implementation of the sewer system. We were trucking out effluent for the first 2 years of the development of you know, 1,200 houses or 1,500 houses that were going in. We're now being told by the agencies involved is that that has now been pushed out because of unforeseen design implementation changes for the sewer scheme, and we may be trucking out effluent for the foreseeable future till 2027. And when we say that, that's 18 truck movements per day, 18 tankers per day trucking out effluent. And that's considered a reasonable solution where the agencies have constraints on them in terms of their budgets, and they're just trying to meet those concerns of Treasury at the time. But there is an opportunity that we can deliver everything that we need in terms of the goals and aspirations of both the state and federal in terms of houses on the ground if we got the implementation right in the first place to unlock the delivery of those houses. So we're in a position where we have to hold back supply because the initial design work that should have been done much earlier in the piece was not completed in time.
Can we point to an example in your growth area councils where it has been done the way you'd like it to be done always? Are there some good examples, Bron?
Yeah, there's some good examples in Perth of, you know, with Metronet, which is a major public transport infrastructure development. And I suppose because it's all being built now with the value of a lot of hindsight, you know, some of our more outlying members in Perth's growth areas are seeing some really sensible density and development built around new train stations. So, you know, there's still, you know, a lot to catch up on there, but that's some good examples of actually looking at things from a 21st century perspective, which is, you know, you can live, as Matt says, like he's, you know, he's about 80 k's out of Sydney CBD, and, you know, in Melbourne it can be 60, 70, 80 k's as well. There's nothing to say you can't live in a great apartment block near a train station, because not every person needs to travel into a capital city CBD for work. And so we'd love to see, you know, some better density around existing transport hubs. And that, we're not just talking about, you know, people think outer suburbs, and I hate that term that people say suburban sprawl, when it's actually just expansion. You know, we don't need to place a value judgment on what's happening. But still, developers are thinking, well, we'll do some greater density, but it will be squeezing more single or double-storey townhouses onto one block rather than an apartment block. So there are some great examples in the south of Perth where this is happening. Well, you know, probably around you know, it's hard, Chris, to find the really good example of where the major infrastructure has been built first.
Yeah.
You know, it's really such a game of catch up.
Yeah. Well, I would say the Western Sydney Airport was the first time where I saw the federal government take a strong leadership position in the delivery of upfront infrastructure. Like that is kind of clinic infrastructure that is driving a complete transformation of Western Sydney, and particularly the local governments that are very nearby, which is Penrith and Liverpool councils as well. So I think they've done some stuff that's really good there. Look, it's never ever perfect, but that is something that is, once again, like the Perth example where the infrastructure was going in first, like the train lines to the airport, and also the freeways and the upgrades to the roads were put in first. And that has had a transformational impact to the whole of Southwest and Western Sydney.
Matt, is this the Aerotropolis that you're talking about? We've seen big plans released, I think, just this week. Yeah. That's what that's all about?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's had huge benefits to the local governments that are closest to that airport and the transformation there. I think my only one criticism that I would have at the moment is that the state government is very focused on the new city that they're building, which is called Bradfield, at the expense of not understanding the other local governments in and around and what they could actually bring to the table with, giving them the enabling infrastructure to be able to unlock a lot of that potential. So, but once again, it's been great to see an example of where the feds have stepped in and said, no, we will invest because we can see that there is it's worthwhile over the long term.
So, Bron, when you mentioned this ideal, I guess, for some of being able to live close to a transport hub and some of the state governments, particularly I think Vic and New South Wales recently have announced housing policies and aims to do just that. But it's had a bit of a sting in the tail, hasn't it? Because it's also the language is about councils haven't been doing enough to deliver housing. Now, look, probably preaching to a converted audience here. We know it's much more complex than that. But how does the NGAA respond to those claims that councils haven't been doing their fair share?
We show the data. We show the evidence that says growth areas have accommodated, you know, something like 15% of population growth in recent years, received much, much less than that in infrastructure funding. We look at the development application timelines and the completion rates. You know, there is so much happening in growth area councils. They're not the problem. And I get very frustrated when commentators just take a broad sweep at local government overall, and there is still so much development happening in all of our member councils, and there is, you know, there's still 10, 20, 30 years worth of growth to happen in some areas, and it's happening as quickly as it ever has. Local government doesn't actually build the houses. So, you know, and we're looking at this economic situation where it's not the best time to be a developer or a building business or a construction business. It's very tough. And so I feel like all the players, whether it's state government wanting to fulfill their housing accord targets so they'll get, you know, a bonus from the federal government, or whether it's the federal government needing to look like they're solving the housing crisis, especially during this election cycle, by getting things done, you know, there's no time and there's no point in this sort of just blaming each other. I think people are, you know, different sectors are doing their best. Growth area councils are approving developments. They're getting through housing delivery as quickly as they ever have. And we can't risk taking an eye off that. Because if the focus shifts to inner and middle ring suburbs and councils where, you know, it will take a long time to deliver housing targets and to deliver density in those areas, it's so much quicker to develop a greenfield site. And, you know, there's so many risks involved in all of that. One is, you know, setting those targets that it cannot be met. It's actually then holding up development to, you know, focus it into existing suburbs, which is a fantastic and really important part of addressing the crisis. But it takes longer. It leaves people without housing for longer. Mm-hmm. Versus, you know, getting on it and delivering. And we'd love to work with developers more to deliver better housing, to deliver better developments in growth areas. So we don't, it doesn't all have to be, you know, there's no such thing as a quarter acre block anymore, Chris. It's more like a 200 square metre block. And, you know, we don't need to just do single dwelling after single dwelling as far as the eye can see. We can do apartments. We can do high rises. And some of our members do have that and have developed this great city, you know, that might not be close to an existing capital city metropolis, but it's part of the greater metropolitan area, and they're cities in their own right. So some of our members are at that stage. Others are just starting this growth journey and are delivering, you know, fantastic affordable housing for people who really want to choose, who choose and really want to live in these areas.
Probably not the time to tell you that I'm recording this with you sitting on my 5-acre block on the outskirts of Greater Geelong, and I'm very happy to be so, I've got to say. But Matt, given Bron's comments and that, you know, and I agree, there's no point playing a blame game here. Is the problem solvable from your perspective? What needs to happen now and quickly?
The short answer is yes, absolutely. And I think that the growth area councils are best placed to be part of the solution, particularly in the short to medium term. We have everything in place ready to go. We just really need the state and federal governments to come on board and actually see that the opportunity for us to be able to meet their shared goals and vision for the delivery of houses can be done through growth areas in combination with looking at that medium to long-term picture of the middle ring suburbs and inner city metros as well. So it's the solution is all of us, it involves all of us, but growth areas are ready to go now. And all we need is a commitment from the state and federal to partner with us in the delivery of, because that is where we can actually deliver real meaningful change at a state and national level. So I'm very optimistic that we are part of the solution. It really comes down to working and getting our state and federal counterparts to see that. So I'm very encouraged that we are seeing at a federal level.
Right. Is Cloverton an exemplar here? Can we talk a little bit about what's happening there? That involves a number of councils, very much a greenfield site, Bron.
Yeah, it's a great example. And, you know, it's three councils. So it's Hume City Council, the City of Whittlesea and Mitchell Shire Council.
In Victoria,
northern outskirts of Melbourne, who've all who are all working together on a development of a major new activity centre and development around it. So it's Cloverton is the name of the suburb. It's going to be in proximity to some fantastic new employment centres around Beveridge Intermodal Freight Terminal and others. And it's a great example of municipal boundaries not being a barrier to smart development. So three councils signed an MOU. They had a joint council meeting. They will be working together to make sure the state government lives up to its part as well, but also with the developers and the landowners. This is a chance to build a new city, basically. And there is so much expertise in local government and across development sector to know how to do that the right way. And yes, every level of government has a role to play, but so do you know, developers, so do those eight state agencies, so do community groups and the community sector. There's such a great opportunity to build this new city in a way that serves the people who will live there, that's sustainable, and that is, you know, prepared for climate change, and the way that's going to impact how we all live. So that's a great example. We have a great in-depth study on that on our website. We have a lot of research and case studies for people who'd like to delve deeper into a lot of the good work that our councils are doing. So you could have a look at it there. But it's a really good example of local government just doing things, you know, just getting things done, basically.
You mentioned those councils needing to make sure that the state government delivers on its part here. Is this going to be an example of what we were talking about before, where the infrastructure does precede the people arriving?
We hope so, Chris.
That's the plan, isn't it?
That is the plan. Yeah. That is the plan. And, you know, that is the plan. And, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, everything built and completed and roads open and rail lines built before anyone moves in. But it has to be in a reasonable period of time. Mm. And it has to embrace things like buses. You know, different states, people love the buses, and Victorians not so much. But, you know, we know that families will move into their new home. And if those local connections, the last mile connections, and it could be a bus or it could be a smart bus or any other combination of new technology and public transport, it won't take long before they'll buy their second car, or if they've got adult children, their third car. And guess what? They're not going to leave that at home and get the bus eventually. They're set in their behavioural patterns then. So the local transport has to happen very quickly. But the major ones, of course, that's the goal. It's why we're trying, you know, those councils are working very hard to try a different way of pursuing this development and delivering what communities need.
Can we switch topics? There's a couple of other things I do want to get your thoughts on before we wrap up. One being what's happening at the local government level to deal with climate change. This must be so frustrating for councils, not having control of all the levers, but being at the coalface. And we're seeing, obviously, those impacts play out with more extreme weather events very much in recent months. What's the NGA position on climate change and local government's role?
We are very adamant that new houses should not be built in disaster-prone areas. It still is happening. And we also have some great examples of how local government, and I suppose this is a cost-shifting outcome, you know, the role of disaster response and recovery in local government in the last 20 years has just, you know, it's taken over. It's shifted responsibility for so much of that onto local government. And so we've got, you know, some great examples of Penrith City Council, for example, in Sydney, taking that and running with it. So they now have a fantastic data dashboard that that tells their community in real time everything that's going on. So local governments had to take the lead there. We've got a great example of Mount Barker District Council in South Australia, who've got a fantastic partnership with their surrounding LGAs and climate and sustainability bodies, where they're all focused on incorporating climate response and sustainability into everything they do. It's really changing the way development happens. It needs to change even faster than it is. So, you know, higher level of green building requirements. There needs to be more sensible planning of where development happens. So just one sort of containment road on the edge of a state forest isn't enough. You know, and so on that side of things, that's important. And then on the other hand, you have this vital part, which is community readiness and community resilience. So growth areas are the first home for many migrants moving to Australia, many people who for the first time will live through an Australian summer and bushfire season. And, you know, we all need, you know, local government's playing such a key role in educating those people and providing the community liaison and engagement to make sure people know what to do. So we're really adamant that, I mean, just look at the news and, you know, Matt can talk about bushfires and floods and landslides, but, you know, almost every week in summer, there's a fire somewhere on the outskirts of a capital city. And that's where our members are, and that's where new houses are still being built. But, you know, a great example that Matt has is around when federal government just gave money directly to the councils to use in a disaster response. Matt, do you want to talk about that one?
Yeah, look, I think that was one of the best things that the federal government could have possibly done, where there was no strings attached. Funding that was provided for disaster relief, it was a great example of the Fed's understanding the local government's ability to deliver the disaster response in an immediate fashion, as opposed to the other example where you have the national disaster funding arrangements that can take anywhere from 2 to 3 years for funding to receive funding for damage that was occurred during any disasters within local government areas. Local government, as you would be aware, Chris, do not have the balance sheets or the ability to forward fund projects for up to 3 years, particularly of significant value. When the feds came in and just said, here is the immediate funds to go do the necessary works, just tell us what you spent it on at the end, that was by far the best thing that they could have possibly done for a disaster recovery. And I think that there needs to be a very similar response in terms of resilience too. We need the feds to understand how best to invest at a local level to get the results in terms of building more resilient communities too. I don't think we've got the settings or the policy quite right there either yet. I think that there needs to be a proper conversation or a renegotiation of at a state and federal level too around where those costs lie, because as you'd be aware, the burdens and the cost shifting that goes on in local government has, I think, taken the sector almost to breaking point in many areas. And I certainly, growth areas have that additional burden of investment in local infrastructure at the same time as all of this resilient and also a recovery work that does occur. So it's a huge burden for us at that level. And I think that is something that needs to be addressed in the future. Otherwise, we're going to see significant failures at a local government level if we don't get a renegotiation of that, the funding arrangements.
Mm. What has COVID done for the way growth areas are developing? Can we still see its impacts, or is it in the rearview mirror?
No, I think we can definitely still see some impacts, especially around the working from home sort of pattern that we're all following. We are all looking at us. We are all doing it today.
Yep.
You know, obviously, meaning that people don't need to travel long distances, commute 2 hours a day, either in their private vehicle or on public transport to get to the office, it means a lot to those families, those individuals and those families, as well as the communities they operate in, let alone the environment. So during COVID lockdowns and just after the lockdowns, we did some market research and found some really interesting outcomes. One was that people who are looking after the kids at home, so they might not be working in growth areas, because, you know, quite often, if you're pursuing a professional career, there's simply not enough time in the day to get from your outer suburban house to childcare, to the train, to the city to do your work and get back to pick up that child in time. So it rules a lot of people, and predominantly women, out of the workforce, out of pursuing their career path. So what we found with our research is that people at home with the kids, if there's another adult around working from home, they've got much greater opportunity and interest to pursue either some, working at a co-working space nearby, or working from home themselves, or taking up some study, or starting their own business. It just means that one adult in the family is not tied down and sort of kept solely responsible for all of the childcare and home duties. If that can be shared by someone simply being home during the day, it's the increase in productivity potential is great if it means another person can enter the workforce. We then looked, after the lockdowns, and people compared to their inner city counterparts, the stress levels had gone down. People were sleeping better. They had more time to spend with their family. They were getting involved in local community activities. So all of these things, which previously they just could not do because they didn't have enough time in the day. So we like to think setting up as a new development occurs and as a precinct structure plan is delivered, you know, if there's a co-working space or a business hub and a community centre, you know, it just means people can live their whole lives in their local area. They don't need to travel long distances and spend, you know, our research shows up to 17% of household income transport costs just to get to work.
That's the aim of the 20-minute city, isn't it?
So
can I perhaps link that to a last question for you, Matt? We've got, I think, our three biggest states are all going to local government elections this year. Queensland very shortly, New South Wales in September, as you would know, and Victoria in October. There's a rise of views out there in the community that people are saying that we should expect to play out more strongly this time around at municipal elections. How big a risk is that for the work of the NGAA and the positions you have on things like 20-minute cities?
Unfortunately, the vision for 20-minute cities has not necessarily been delivered by those that have painted the vision. And I'm thinking more at the New South Wales examples, where we've just seen the Minns government completely wash the Greater Sydney Commission away, and that whole vision for the 20-minute city. I think the intent was good, but the practicalities of on the ground delivery had not been worked out. But I do see that the solution is local government. And I have seen where local governments are working towards creating those walkable cities, putting in those co-working hubs. I think that that will have a significant factor at the upcoming elections, where you will see the difference between the naysayers and those that do have a vision for their local areas and their communities in creating places where there is a better quality of life in those areas. That is something that we notice with outer growth areas. The people moving into those areas are aspirational. They want to move there because it's a great place to live. They can see the vision, and those that can paint the vision and actually help deliver on the ground results are those that they're going to want to follow. So I think that this local government election across all three states is actually going to be really interesting to watch in outer growth areas as to what types of elected officials actually end up taking up responsibility for these key areas. I'm very keen to see the outcome and see how that plays out with, I guess, what we're seeing on the ground as well. So it's going to be a lot of fun, Chris.
Interesting times ahead.
I hope you've got. Have you got a version of the what is it, the tally room for local government? I think that there is an opening there for a new podcast.
Yes, stay tuned. Stay tuned on that one. But always keep an eye on lgnewsroundup.com for some of that information. But Bron, does the election cycle impact on you and the work that you do? Does it have much impact?
Not too much, because you know, the way that we've been able to develop our foundational beliefs, I suppose, is to find the common denominators, and not to go down to the lowest common denominator, but to bring them up to what's the highest level of things that we all agree on and go from there. And so, you know, we will leave the local politics to the local politicians, and we will, you know, I'm big fan of policy over politics, Chris, and it's a bit nerdy to say, but I'm proud of it, and I'm very happy to leave all of the local politics to our members themselves, and we have a fantastic team of elected officials who are, you know, appointed to guide our work, and Matt as chair does a great job of that.
Matt's laughing.
Very diplomatic answer there, Bron.
And it's about exactly what I expected she would say, Matt, to be honest. All right. Look, it's been there's so much more we could talk about. So I hope maybe you'll be open to another chat down the track. We've covered a lot of ground there. And I really do want to thank you both for your insights and your time today on the Roundup. Councillor Matthew Deeth, the Deputy Mayor at Wallandilly Shire Council, lovely to have you on the program, Matt, and all the best to you. I'm not going to put you on the spot about September, but whatever might come later in the year.
Thank you, Chris. I very much enjoyed the chat. Thanks for having us on the show.
You're very welcome. And Bronwyn Clark, CEO of the NGAA. Lovely to see you again, Bronwyn.
Thanks,
and
Chris.
And to speak with you. Really appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Matt Deeth and Bronwyn Clark, Chair and CEO, respectively, of the National Growth Areas Alliance. I hope you've enjoyed this special edition of the podcast, brought to you by the Victorian Local Governance Association, with support from Davidson Recruitment and Business Advisory Services. Our regular editions will return soon when we get underway for Season 4 of the Roundup, but check your podcast queue for more special editions of the program in the meantime. Thanks for listening, and bye for now. The Local Government News Roundup is brought to you by the Victorian Local Governance Association. As Victorian councils go to elections later this year, the VLGA is ready to support communities and councils in good governance. A series of workshops has been designed to increase understanding of the local government sector, the work of councils, and the role of a councillor. Registrations are being taken now for workshops in May on standing for local government and local women leading change. And member councils should look out for the VLGA's 2024 Local Government Election Pre-Candidate Prospectus, available soon. Find out more about how the VLGA can support your council and community during this important time in the local government election cycle. Visit vlga.org.au.